Hello and welcome to SF3, a podcast where we review the latest of science fiction and fantasy audiobooks.
Also not the latest, they might be old books.
They might be giants, you never know. What are we going to do unless they are? Today, what are we reading, Kevin?
Psychology of Time Travel.
By Kate Mascarenhas. Narrated by Ellie Hayden. So first of all, this is the first new podcast that we've recorded in quite a while. Now, it might not actually seem that way, because in terms of the production schedule, you might have gotten some previous episodes in the queue before this, or you might not have. I don't know. The only real difference is that we are currently recording in the mysterious year 2024.
The future.
The future. And Barry is not with us on this podcast. We're going to leave the reasons that Barry is not with us as a glorious and grand mystery.
It's an exercise left for the reader.
Yes. For any new listeners or anyone that doesn't remember our format, what we normally do is we do a spoiler-free review at the beginning of the podcast where we talk about the book so that you can think about whether or not that's something you'd be interested in reading. And then you can decide for yourself if you want to stay with us for the second half of the podcast where we will have a full spoilery discussion.
Or pause it, read the book, and then come back to the glorious discussion.
Precisely. Because that is a form of time travel. So, I shall read from the back of the book this week because it's not really entirely clear to me which of us picked this book in true time travel fashion.
Probably Barry.
So yes, we blame Barry for all things that happen that we don't really understand. So yes, it was definitely Barry's fault. From the back of the book, in 1967, four female scientists worked together to build the world's first time machine. But just as they are about to debut their creation, one of them suffers a breakdown, putting the whole project and future of time travel in jeopardy. To protect their invention, one member is exiled from the team, erasing her contributions from history. 50 years later, time travel is a big business. 20-something Ruby Ribello knows her beloved grandmother, Granny B, was one of the pioneers, though no one will tell her more. But when B receives a mysterious newspaper clipping from the future reporting the murder of an unidentified woman, Ruby becomes obsessed. Could it be B? Who would want her dead? And most importantly of all, can her murder be stopped? Traversing the decades and told from alternating perspectives, The Psychology of Time Travel introduces a fabulous new voice in fiction and a new must-listen for fans of speculative fiction and women's fiction alike. Kevin, what did you think of this book?
Overall, I enjoyed it. It did take me a little bit to get into it at first. And I definitely, as much as I've read and watched, you know, many decades of time travel fiction, there were definitely some confusing bits in it. Still, by the end, it ended up being pretty satisfying, I would say, overall.
Yeah, I agree. The thing that I would recommend to readers is you should take the title of the book seriously. This is a book about the psychology of time travel. It's less of a time travel adventure story or some kind of murder mystery like they kind of make it out in the back of the book. And it's actually really a book about what happens to people's minds when they have to travel in time and deal with the realities or unrealities of that. I spent a lot of my first read of this book puzzling over things that frankly turned out not to matter and didn't really grasp the core of the book until the reread. Now, I think that it is a book that definitely is good to read twice. Everybody in the book interacts in utterly insane ways because of time travel, because half the people in the book are time travelers. I only understood how two of them were related when writing up the character list that we keep in front of us for this podcast. So just understand that your first read through, you might not get all the subtleties, and just go back and read through it again, and a lot more things may be revealed. Or do a podcast about it. I find that very useful.
Yeah, sometimes I have to understand it while we do the podcast.
I thought that the narration was very well done by the narrator, Ellie Hayden. She did some good, subtle accent work distinguishing the large quantities of characters. What did you think?
Yeah, she actually did a really good job. And you're right. It was nice that it was fairly subtle, too, that it wasn't some radio drama from the 50s like type of exaggeration for everything. But right. You could instantly tell usually who the different characters were.
Yes.
And I will say, too, you know, we can get into it later, but they did get into their own physics of time travel in this universe.
Yes.
You know, just like Back to the Future and Doctor Who and so forth have their own. And
I think more like the metaphysics. They didn't really delve.
Well, yeah. It wasn't a how does it work, but they definitely go into the like, well, what about this kind of paradox? And can you change history or can you not? Is it predetermined or is it not?
Right.
You know, are there different timelines and so forth? And so they definitely answer those questions. And sometimes they answer them just in the course of events happening. And you kind of figure it out implicitly that it must happen this way without them saying, this is exactly how this happens.
Right.
And they do, I guess we can keep it really spoiler free, but they do mention existing time travel fiction.
Oh, yes. There's a rabbit with a very funny name.
Yes, and it is within the first couple paragraphs, but we'll save it, I guess. We could just say its name is Patrick, and yes. Some people may get that.
Sure. All right, well, it's now time for us to travel forward in time a few seconds to keep you from feeling the dreaded time travel psychological effects of spoilers. When we come back, we'll have a full spoiler-filled discussion of the psychology of time travel.
Huzzah!
All right, welcome back to our discussion section, where we will discuss all of the finer points of Psychology of Time Travel by Kate Mascarenhas. One of the things that I wanted to talk about, one of the first things that happens in the book is after the initial run of time travel by the first time travelers, one of them, named B, has a breakdown during a press conference that causes tremendous ripple effects down the entire timeline because Margaret, who is in charge of the time travel organization, then becomes extraordinarily angry with B for, as she sees it, messing up their public image by basically having a manic episode during a press conference. On my first reading, I thought that this was a mystery to be solved. And I'm still not entirely convinced that it's not, but I'm willing to just accept that this was just a thing that happened. After all, in real life, people have manic episodes at inconvenient times sometime.
Right. That was my first thought, too, that in the beginning, the women who all created time travel, which, you know, the all-women cast of scientists,
right.
You know, in the late 60s, which is a good thing in the book and not, you know, particularly well publicized for things that happened in the 60s,
right?
As our history goes, although plenty of things like that happened that weren't publicized because, you know, things are awesome, if you want to term it that way.
Yes. So everybody else goes to bed. B gets up and does some more time traveling. And I spent the entire book sort of waiting to find out that she went somewhere that affected her mind or was replaced by some sort of alternate person or something like that. Or that right. Time travel itself had some sort of deep spiritual effect because there were multiple people trying to inhabit the same timeline or something like that. And it turned out B just happens to be bipolar, and from overdoing it and getting disconnected from her sleep-wake cycle and that sort of thing, she had a manic episode at an inconvenient time, which can happen.
Right. So like you were saying, I had the same thing where I was thinking, okay, it's going to be like a Bill and Ted thing where she goes in the future, does something off-screen that we will see the ripples of throughout the book, or at some critical juncture, you know, the unknown woman will show up and, you know, save the day or cause something horrible to happen by accident or something. And as we were saying during the segue, it's like maybe she found out some things and then that caused her to do other things later that were very subtle, but then ended up kind of saving the day at the end, but we don't know because it's off screen. And I didn't pick it apart that much to see if I noticed the subtle clue. You know, I didn't notice it on the reread. So,
right.
What I was thinking was that, you know, at the end, her granddaughter was being tried, Ruby, right, was being tried for killing the boss, basically, in revenge for the boss being the cause of her grandmother's death.
Right.
And this is all told out of order, so it takes a little bit to figure out what's going on and what was a result of something else. But
right. We have a character named Odette who is obsessed with finding out who murdered a random person whose body she happened to discover. It turned out that her psychologist was Ruby, who was Bee's granddaughter. Everybody in the book is meshed together in this extraordinarily complex web. And I actually was thinking about like building a wiki out of all of these different characters because they are all tied together.
Well, right. Isn't Odette like married to Grace, one of the original people?
Yes. Yes.
And, but we don't know that until almost the very end. And they're kind of,
right,
you know, randomly hooking up in a small part of the book, but.
Right. So yes, to jump back and forth a little bit, just like the book does, this is a time travel universe in which things are predestined or are at least fixed.
Right. You can't change something, but you appear to be able to interact with it. But then right. I was a little unclear whether that means you could go back and do something new or whether if you go back, you had already done it and you just didn't notice it the first time. Like when Odette is doing her initial kind of interview and it's the question, how do you prevent crime using time travel? And they go back an hour and a painting has been vandalized and people are trying to stop it from happening. And Odette kind of thinks, well, it's more interesting to figure out why they did it. And then people were saying, well, wouldn't it create, you know, the standard, like, well, if you stopped it, then why would we come back to look because it hadn't happened?
Sure.
And it would be like a paradox. And so, you know, and they never show them. Well, they do kind
of. They do. So there's that one scene in there where they have catapults for some reason.
Yeah, which I guess are slingshots, I'm assuming they're saying.
I guess, yeah. So they're trying to basically take out all the lights in the room to make it impossible to see the painting, to slash it, which is the crime that they were trying to prevent.
Or the other ones, I think, but that too, yeah.
Yes. They were just trying to take out the lights in the room. They're firing slingshots at this chandelier, and they're just continually missing, despite the fact that it's right there.
And the person says they were like excelled at it or won some prize on marksmanship and even they couldn't hit anything. And then like right at the very end, Odette, I think what it was in the future, she saw the light for the recorder on.
Yeah, she had specifically noticed that because she was thinking, oh, we're being recorded.
Ah, okay. But then when she goes back to now, it's not on and she thinks, well, it'd be helpful to turn it on so that we can record the crime and get evidence for the future. And then she says, oh, she kind of knew intuitively that she would be able to do it because she had to hit the button with the slingshot.
Right. She does this improbable shot with a slingshot and manages to turn the camera on from across the room. So anything that is potentially chance-related, and that, guess what, kids, is everything, is controlled by the timeline, aka fate.
Right. And they even talk about how in the future, psychology is not a thing because everyone is of the religion of time travel. I forget the name, but basically sure. That, you know, God has fated everything. And if you could change it, you know, if God would let you change it, then you would be able to, but you can't. So therefore, everything is fated by God or the gods. I forget the specifics, but.
Sure. There are also things called genies.
Yes.
Now, in my very, very particular lexicon, I call those twonkies, but they're basically items or pieces of information that are stuck in stable time loops, closed time-like curves.
Like, yeah, self-creating things and events that are
right
create themselves.
Yeah, there's a wedding ring that travels back and forth from the future to the past, and it's a ring of curious design. They're introduced relatively late in the book, if I remember correctly.
Right. And they tried to hand wave science a bit where they said, well, nobody knows why, but every time traveler has a ton of them. And they think that maybe energy is somehow created with time travel and the energy has to go somewhere. So it just creates random knickknacks, and, you know, they don't mean anything, but every time traveler also has their own book.
Yes.
That sort of might be gibberish, or it might, you know, be cryptic things and who knows right. what.
Now, I would be astonished if this weren't a reference to Jorge Luis Borges' The Library of Babel, which is one of the favorite books that I read when I was in college, which is basically just a story about a library that is so huge it contains every possible book in it. The books are of a fixed length, so it's finite, but just gigantic. And so there are people that live within the library, and each one wants to find the book that contains the explanation of everything in their life that makes them look like an absolute hero.
But they ignore the ones where they're evil or whatever.
Well, I mean, there are
or
so
that
many
they're
books
just like random, right. you know, people that do nothing and aren't very heroic or something.
I mean, most of the books are just utter gibberish. So
right, a blue like, furry fish, as my friend in high school used to say.
Yeah, I remember like one line from that being, the most coherent book that I have in my collection begins with the phrase "combed clap of thunder." That's the only thing that makes any sense in it.
Well, I suppose we could add that book to the list if
just "combed clap of thunder," then just a bunch of gibberish. I suppose going to be a fairly short review.
I meant the. The actual book, but anyway.
Yes, it's a short story, but absolutely.
Ah, okay. The thing that makes it more of a pivotal concept other than random knickknacks appear is that the time travel authority, whatever the name is here, has their own justice system because it has to go across all timelines or all time.
Right. And it's not really a justice system.
Yeah, they said it's very akin to medieval justice where basically you have a trial that is set and it's set by one of these items that the judge receives from their future self.
Right.
And basically the scroll usually says something that you have to go do or whatever. And in this particular one, Ruby has a trial of memory and she has to recall three plot points from the book The Box of Delights, which it turns out is an actual book written in 1935 and apparently a beloved, you know, fantasy book in England, which of course means in the US nobody's heard of it, like, but Wikipedia knows about it. But anyway, the interesting thing about this that folds into the, oh, did something happen when Barbara slash B goes into the future and something happens, but we don't ever see it on screen, is she has to recall the lines from this book. Well, her grandmother read her this book so many times as a kid that she knows it by heart.
Right.
And so is this one of those like time loop type things where, you right. know, she is quote fated to be found innocent. So therefore her grandmother knew it and told to her, or her grandmother didn't know it and just told to her because it was a great book and somehow because she was fated to be innocent, that was what her trial was, you know, right. and the universe created it, you know, slash the, you know, the future time God created it, or what was yeah. it that caused this to happen? You know, was this really like trying to enact, you know, the medieval concept of like, yes, well, God's on your side and you're fated to win. Therefore, in this
we'll
combat trial, you
dunk
won.
You in the water here to see if you're a witch.
Yeah, exactly. Is this sort of saying like, yes, there is something that causes things to happen, or the universe just has weird time cycles, and that's just what the physics of time travel is.
Yeah. If B's sort of hidden trip has a lot of significance, my God, it's incredibly subtle. I think that they're talking about time loops.
Yeah, and, you know, there's other things that do happen. Like she gets a note from the future that kind of starts Ruby looking into the whole, you know, is this her grandmother that ends up dead because she just gets the note saying that, oh, someone's dead.
Right.
And she wants to try to prevent it.
And she actually is talking to Grace, whose future self sent the note. And Grace is like, I don't know why older time travelers get really weird about death.
Right. And yeah, then there's that whole kind of major part of the book, but again, not really cemented till later on, where Margaret is really concerned about the public image, especially after the breakdown of Barbara for the first, you know, time travel press conference. So she basically starts this sort of like hard line, you know, like, oh, if you've ever been on any kind of antidepressants, you're out. You know, if you've ever had a mental breakdown of any kind, you're out because it could recur or you can have it again. And so, you know, people, they show people trying to hide it or, you know, they are taking something for off-label use. And then, but they're like, sorry, it doesn't matter. You know, you can't come in because people are trying to lie. So we're helping you. Ha ha. They basically do these hazing rituals where they do the angel of death, where you go, they look up when somebody's family member gets killed in an accident. And then they'll go like an hour before or 20 minutes before and say, you know, hey, your dad's going to be killed very soon today or whatever. And that's like part of your rituals. You have to go and say it to the younger person. They have a variety of these sort of hazing rituals that people aren't really into doing, but they kind of make them do it to dissociate their emotions from the job.
Right. It's sort of this very odd version of like Buddhism or something. A more, shall we say, mature form of spiritualism might be to understand that everybody must die and that's something just to be accepted and celebrated. But since this organization is led by somebody with narcissistic personality disorder, then everything turns into Margaret, who like is a baroness turned cosmologist. Then it all turns into a kind of snobbery where they basically pick random people whose parents are about to die or are about to have a tragedy and rub their noses in it and make new recruits do this in order to understand that, well, we are different from, they called them the emus, you know, because they couldn't walk backwards.
Oh, yeah, I remember that line, but I didn't remember what the reference was, but right. And
it's actually not something that I knew about emus before.
See, reading does wonders. And so
the more you know.
And knowing is half the battle. And so one of the things is the candy box game. Basically, they have this across time trade within the time travel organization where they'll buy things from one time and sell it in another time to make money to sort of fund their time travel. One of the things that they released early on was this candy box where you would, you know, it was a children's toy. I mean, imagine, you know, the ridiculousness of selling something like that now. But basically, you know, it does remind me of early, not very safe toys that it's like, oh, just be safe. It'll only put out your eye if you're not careful. Like, and so, and basically that's what happened is you drop something into the box. It sends it forward 1 minute into the future. So people would, you know, drop their candy into it. Then it would pop out and the kids would eat it and say, oh, it tastes better, you know, which it's the same, but just went through time. So of course it was exciting. And, but you know, something like some percentage of the time it would shoot out, you know, something would go wrong with the device and it would sort of shoot out like a bullet and it's, you know, hit the wall really fast and, you know, could hurt you if you were like leaning over it when you drop something in.
Right. They never really specified where the velocity comes from or whether it just always comes out at the same rate as it goes in or if it's much faster. I assume it comes out faster than it goes in.
I think so, because there were some where they were showing them just dropping marbles or something in. They basically came out like bullets.
Right.
So in the candy box game, it's sort of like, will you or won't you shoot a gun into it? And then it's kind of like Russian roulette, but it's candy box roulette where, you know, if you happen to be staying there at the wrong time, it might shoot a bullet out.
So, yes, this was Margaret's favorite game, Margaret the insane baroness. What normally happened was she would take someone that she had some disagreement with or just wanted to, like, dominate and give that person the opportunity to fire into the candy box. And usually that person would refuse because she actually seemed quite horrified when Ruby actually fired bullets into it towards the end.
Right. But was that because she knew then that she might get shot by the bullets later or because she was just...
Yeah. It seemed clear that she thought that this might contribute to her death because there was something about, you know, she knew she had been brought a little bit closer to her own death, I think was a line in there.
Yes, because Ruby basically just empties the remaining bullets into it immediately, like one after the other.
Right.
Whereas usually the person will waffle, kind of say that they don't want to do it. And I think it was more of a power trip.
Right.
you know, for Margaret, where she would just be like, ha, you know, get in your place. You know, if you're not going to do this, you know, you got to do what I say. And she would sort of make people do these to kind of like berate them and kind of keep them in line. And especially people that, you know, showed mental issues afterwards. And that was even a point in the book where they said, notice how Margaret doesn't travel through time at all.
Right.
That maybe she, you know, realized that she would also have breakdowns like Barbara did, but because she was not willing to deal with that, she just said, well, you know, I'm more fixed and someone else will do all that stuff for me. You know, I'm not all scatterbrained like some of those time travel people. And, you know, I could run things easier just by, you know, keeping like a linear track or something.
Right.
And yeah. Oh yeah. That was one of the things that was that were that, you know, before when we were talking about, you know, the weirdness of mortality with time travelers and that kind of thing was that they talk about how, you know, well, she was trying to get down. Oh, did you kill or were you trying to kill Margaret? And they were like, well, what's the point? They're right. Like, because we would just have to go back in time when she was still alive and she would still be mean to us. So, you know, it's sort of like, you know, you might say, oh, something to look forward to in the future if you were going to do it, but that it wouldn't really make any day-to-day difference because they weren't actually dead. And they kind of said that was not really a problem, but something that
right
gave a different perspective to time travelers when, you know, the loved ones might die, but they could just go back in time to see them at another time. So it was like they weren't really gone. They could just whenever they felt like it. One of the time travelers has some kind of obsessive compulsive disorder, and she has something related to eating where she would start eating less and less because she was feeling like a ghost, because she couldn't really change anything that she could just observe essentially. So it got to the point where she would only eat if she returned to the moment of her birth.
Right. And that actually wasn't really shown much as a full scene, but the image of that was my favorite image of the book. She is skin and bones. She's only allowing herself to eat at the moment of her birth. She is surrounded by different versions of herself.
And it must have been hundreds or thousands because she said she went back thousands of times, right?
Right. But she can tell by the size of the crowd that it's not going to last that much longer. And then she sees her mother, who is a psychologist, on a nearby hillside observing, trying to understand what's going on.
I think she does get treatment at some point, and so maybe it's that she doesn't die, but she just stops going back.
Right.
I was thinking that it kind of related to the fact that apparently it's very expensive to get the atroposium to, like, you know, fuel the time travel, which is like the made-up radioactive isotope mined from, what, rubies or something that is very difficult and expensive to get.
As we were talking about it before this, we realized that it's named after the fate that is in charge of, like, clipping off the end of your lifeline, Atropos, the one who cuts.
Yes, which is actually cool, and I kind of wish I had realized that at the time, but it is a nice use of fancy words and roots.
It's also known as writing.
Yes, weird. You put stuff together in a particular linear order to create nonlinear things.
I think both Kevin and I assumed that the Box of Delights was fictional, even though that's just like, there's no such person as Winnie the Pooh.
Yes, exactly.
I had thought that probably Macromonas wasn't real, but that turns out to be like a real bacteria that shows up in here because apparently it flourishes within time machines and they have to have strict decontamination procedures.
Oh, because of the radiation. Yeah, I still wasn't clear whether the one that grows in radiation was a real thing or not, but I know that
I don't think there is a bacteria that lives entirely in time machines.
I dispute that.
Well, I mean, I'm a skeptic. I can't prove you wrong. Yes. Okay. So time, I think, to move on to our usual questions. We've answered some of them already. Was there tea is one of our standard questions. There is only the standard British mention of tea. It's nearly always somebody handing somebody else a cup of tea to calm them down.
Yes, as usual. Or some tea time mention, but that's about it.
Right. It's specifically mentioned as bitter twice. and then there's a character that has a mental disorder where she comes up with new words for things, and she calls tea Schwister.
I thought that was a future term for tea that they would use.
It was unclear. She just said there was one person who used neologisms, assuming that everybody would get them. And it wasn't clear whether this was just her own private idiolect or if this was future talk.
Right. I thought they meant that it was just future slang that nobody got in the past, but she would use it anyway. It was interesting, too, because they made subtle references where they said, like, you know, you could only travel to where the time machine technology exists, so you couldn't go before, what is it, 1967, when they first created it. But you could also couldn't go past sometime in, like, 22 or 2300 when they said, huh, maybe the time travel machinery had been dismantled, and someone kind of fleetingly says something about, you know, which might have been a hallucination, but that there was like essentially some kind of apocalypse that happens in the future, or they're like things were on fire. And I was like, oh, are they subtly saying, and then World War III happens, but we don't have to talk about that. Like, you
know? Yes. And then one review points out that they do make reference to 24th century law at some point.
Yes. That they're like, yes, if we can get the trial held by a 24th century judge, it'll be fine, because like sort of familial revenge is considered okay. Yeah, I thought it too was, you know, they didn't mention much explicitly, but because it started in 1967, we can answer the rabbit question where they said, you know, the rabbit's sort of scruffy, you know, what should we name it? It should have a scruffy name. How about Patrick Troughton?
Right.
And they do explicitly mention Doctor Who.
Yes.
Which it would be, you know, a horrible time crime not to mention Doctor Who in a time travel book based in the UK.
Right, exactly. If they hadn't mentioned Doctor Who or tea, then I'd have just like, I don't care what anybody says. This was not actually written by a British person. As it stands, this is definitely one of the more British books that we've read, and we've read some pretty damn British stuff.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking too, one of my favorite scenes early on was the whole candy box modder scene that they mentioned.
Yes.
Just the, you know, that was sort of the first mention of the candy box, I think, or one of the first mentions. There might've been a, you know, them showing it being used at a birthday party, you know, kid's birthday party. But the fact that they're like, these aren't made anymore, but old modders buy these old boxes and try to mod them to do different things or make them last longer, more than 1 minute and that kind of thing.
It does sort of fit because, like, we're both somewhat involved with communities that take things like Raspberry Pis and so forth and try to make them do stuff. So many people just try to do things without actually understanding what's going on behind the scenes. Oh, well, if we do this and this, and then you can get it this much bigger or this much better.
Right. So they were sort of trying to reverse engineer things and sort of document things as they go. And they do even talk about the internet like it's still a thing in the, you know, 2200s, 2300s or whatever.
Yep. It's a book that in some ways is more optimistic than I am. I think I already mentioned that my favorite scene was the sort of implied scene of the woman with the eating disorder that could only eat in one place, so she was surrounded by thousands of copies of herself, also either frantically or tepidly eating some food.
I got the impression that they were all sort of like barely moving and kind of eating a piece of celery or something.
Right.
But when I was reading that scene, I was sort of thinking, this is like horribly mismanaged. If someone can go back to the same place thousands of times, and they were talking about how expensive the fuel is, and you're thinking they must have mountains and mountains of this fuel if someone could just go back thousands of times to the same spot or to any place and like no one even notices.
Well, yeah. I mean, there was some talk about how their monetary system worked because they had their own system of money that was a factor in all of this. Also, at the end, B figures out a way of drastically reducing the amount of fuel that it takes. And then Margaret says, oh, no, we can't reduce the amount of fuel because half of our political influence is based on people who supply us with the fuel. So, no, we don't want that.
Right, right. It would be, it would make sense, but, you know, we would never get the votes in the future to keep going and stuff. That part was bizarre, though, when I, you know, what is time travel being used for? It seems to be a bunch of crazy people just acting out their neuroses most of the time on camera, which kind of goes back to the name of the book.
Exactly.
But presumably they kind of mention, oh, by the way, it's also being probably used for espionage and other things that make it worthwhile for the government to sponsor.
Sure, but that's sort of a form of linear thinking. I mean, it's being used for whatever it's being used for.
Well, well, right, because they say, like you were saying, that when someone joins, they get a wristwatch that holds their ledger, essentially, of their payments.
Right.
And they get their full lifetime salary when they join. So part of the book was this bizarre investigative reporter looking into taxation of time travelers, because they all go to where, like, there is no taxation to, like, withdraw their earnings for that year, but don't withdraw it during high taxation years usually.
Which is the sort of detail that I really love, because, you know, it's the equivalent of driving to Nevada to buy that thing to avoid sales tax, but with your entire life savings. It's like a 401k, but it's at the beginning of your life and you can go there whenever you want.
Well, right. And because most time travelers know when they're going to die, everything is essentially fated. And there's this whole time travel lingo related to a lot of acts, especially there's this whole subplot of, like, bizarre sexual acts of, like, you know, doing it with yourself. And, like, the last time that you hook up with somebody, or going back in time to see them for the last time before you die, which has to be a reference to the Doctor Who library episode with River Song or something like that. And, like,
there's a beautiful sequences, like, all the sexual slang used by time travelers, including tippler cylinders and flux capacitors are both slang terms for either sexual organs or sexual acts.
Yeah. So, okay. So I guess they do reference Back to the Future at least once.
Sure.
Yeah. I remembered that, but I'd forgotten that that was the term that they'd use until you said that. but that is one thing I always like in sci-fi fantasy stuff, is kind of like picking apart what I term the physics of the book, is, like, you know, how internally consistent.
Right. Metaphysics.
Science.
Right.
In the book, which is essentially fiction, but within the book, it's not. So I think time loops are not something they made, and the fate decision is actually not a common decision in time travel books. It's very rare, I think, to see a time travel book.
Because it's extremely hard to write and keep remotely coherent, or characters that you can put yourself into, because how on earth are you supposed to empathize with a character that knows the future but is going through the motions? And that was actually one of the weirdest parts, was, oh, okay, yes, we knew that there was going to be this time machine accident, and we'd heard about it all our lives, but we had to do it despite that.
Right. It was fated. And they didn't really say, like, oh, we tried to avoid it. In fact, they said they were giddy, and they were all kind of, like, giggling about going in and getting, they all got scars, you know, when it blew up.
Right.
And they called it, what, completion, when you did something that you knew was going to happen.
Right.
The only thing I could think of offhand is, was it Arrival?
Yeah.
That kind of gets into the, oh, this is something that, you know, we know it's going to happen, and it doesn't change, and we do it anyway. And it's sort of, it doesn't seem weird. We're, you know, it just is something that's happening, even though we knew it was going to happen. And it just, it happens because it did happen, and it is happening. So there is no timeline or parallel, at least that they've discussed. But the thing that I think that I can't think of another example of is the, what was the term for it? The time loop objects that just
genies.
Genies, yeah. You know, I thought that was kind of interesting, to have the concept of an object that just appears from nowhere, and usually is some random knickknack, but, you know, sometimes it's a book about yourself in poetry, and you don't know what it means until afterwards, and that kind of thing.
So there was an early science fiction story that I believe was just called As Never Was, and the entire thing that happened in the story was, it was just a description of a dagger that was in this person's possession, and he knows that at some point a time traveler brings it back to the past. And the entire thing is pondering it because the whole thing just exists in a time loop. And the paradox right. that it involves, especially because at one point he knows that they cut away a small piece of it for sampling. And he's just like, but how does that work? You know,
like, how can you remove it? Well, does it go back together?
Or right. Does it regrow? I mean, you know, basically he's, I don't know how this works. I know we take away the piece for sampling. My reading of it was, oh, well, the guy's not thinking it through. Eventually somebody repairs it. Somehow.
Right. Or, you know, it just gets timey-wimey'd back, like, you know.
Right. Well, that was actually the thing that they used to solve it in this book was sometimes objects get changed while they're traveling through time.
Oh, you're right. Like the, what was the ring
The ring called? Of curious something or other. The ring of curious design, I'm going to go with.
But yeah, I think so. Sure. And that was out of the real book. So presumably right. it's in there. In fact, you could probably find it.
I could probably.
Know, on whatchamacallit, Gutenberg. But thinking about the time loops, I kind of think about, you know, there's a section of, you know, Gödel, Escher, Bach, just mm-hmm. to sound like I don't understand anything from that book. There was a section where he's talking about Escher, the self-drawing hands.
Right. Strange loops, I think, is the thing that they talk
yeah,
about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think it kind of goes back to the concept of you can't have, like, self-referential consistent mathematics, like, you know,
right,
that's like the whole thing about the you know, the index that, you know, the index of all indexes, can it contain the index of itself or not?
Right. I think that's Mitkin's. I get lost in those guys, yes.
Well, it's also a math thing, which I forget. But
does the set of all things that do not contain themselves contain itself?
Well, the point is that every library has its own meta index, and that librarian says, like, oh, should I list this book in the index because it's a book of indexes, and then some of them do and some of them don't. And then the thing is, like, well, now, like, the Library of Congress has a meta index of all the indexes. And the question is, you know, you can't put it in either one because it essentially putting it one makes it the other one or something, you know,
right.
which I,
yeah.
if I think about it, we could talk about it, but I won't right now. You know,
right.
I think I was first exposed to that in this glorious 1984-5 Nova episode called A Mathematical Mystery Tour, which was one of my sure. favorite all-time episodes, which is an archive.org, I think.
I mean, the standard one is the barber who shaves all men who do not shave themselves.
And in other weird referential things, and I think that the barber thing is the same, but the music for A Mathematical Mystery Tour was done by the person who did the, you know, mid-80s redo of Doctor Who theme.
I knew that was coming.
Which I only found out recently, and then I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it's the same person.
And now we know, and we're all a little richer for it.
Yes, indeed.
All right, so, well, this is all getting increasingly exciting.
Yes. Well, just to go back to my original thing before you totally cut me off, Peter Howell was the person I was talking about, but
I tried but the, kids.
Yes. The strange loop idea that I think of in a closed time loop is, did it start not closed? Like, you know, they show in the Escher thing, like, you know, Escher is drawing the two hands and that's outside of that frame of reference. And that's kind of how you have to solve these, you know, this math thing is you have to have another sort of frame of reference and you can't have it self-referential and be internally consistent, but you can add another like meta reference that then makes it work.
Yes.
And so the question is like, did it happen linearly? And then the time loop, it was closed when they sent something back. And then the, you know, initial part gets sort of snipped out of time or something like that.
Right.
Or I mean, was it always closed and it just sort of like magically appeared?
Right. I mean, I generally try to solve these problems by adding sort of like a meta time dimension, which doesn't actually make any sense. But
I mean, like, I suppose that's.
But I mean, basically you're like, oh, okay. Well, what actually would have happened, quote unquote, actually is that no one ever takes that sample, that just doesn't happen, because if somebody does take the sample, then there's suddenly an infinite number of samples being taken, and so it's gone now, and so it never looped back, so that part never happened. The real answer is, time travel is impossible. But
what do you mean? I'm super disappointed now.
Yes, well.
People in the book, in that world, try to explain it by that's when the whole can't change the past because God does it and doesn't let you, and it's fated. And so that's kind of, they say they don't know where the genies come from, but I think my assumption would be that the in-world explanation at that point would be, well, you know, of course God makes all that stuff happen.
I don't know. They talk about the religion of predestination, but it's not clear that that's what sort of the author's perspective is. To me, it's sort of like, okay, when there's a feedback loop in a microphone system, who is singing? And the answer is, well, nobody. That pitch just comes out of the mechanics of the system.
Right. The reverb slash the feedback, like you said. So it's the system creates it.
Right.
But originally is created by something at a very low level and it's amplified. So
sure. But that whatever that something is may not sound remotely like what the feedback loop actually is. And so fits in fairly well with what's going on here with inside the book. A lot of the paradoxes are just sort of hand waved by saying, genies tend to be like kind of impervious. You know, they're mysterious objects and they don't really degrade. They don't seem to age. And I'm just like, yeah, they better not seem to age because otherwise it'll be older when it's sent back every single time.
Yes, that's true. But like you said, it changes. Yeah. Sometimes.
Right. It helps it sort of in some ways, but then...
Well, that doesn't... I don't know if they... Do they change, or is it just that the candy box changed it?
The candy box changed it, at least for the ring, at least in one case. But if it changes, I'm not entirely sure how that is self-consistent, because if something changes during transit, how is the original object going to be there for it to be changed into?
Right. So maybe it's sort of like a finite automata graph where it comes in, it kind of does the loop, and then when it goes into the candy box, it exits the loop. But
right. So it doesn't have to be an infinite loop.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know what they do with them. I think you could, I guess that means eventually if time travel went forever, which apparently it doesn't, then you get an infinite number of objects eventually.
Right. Oh. I mean, that's probably what happens in the end. It's like suddenly every single time machine spits out this huge collection of random crap that people have thrown in there for no apparent reason. Just like candy spewing out destroys all of civilization. Because like there's been an infinite number of people, of kids throwing candy into these small boxes. And like there's only one of these boxes left and it just suddenly opens. And like if only 1 in 100 times the candy never comes out, then it just suddenly goes kaboom, and suddenly all of civilization is covered by candy.
I feel like the candy box is something that would show up and get used to save the day in an Doctor Who episode. Where
oh, absolutely. We need to write it. The other question that I wanted to talk about was genre, because like the back of the book makes this sound like a murder mystery. I really didn't feel like it was a murder mystery. Sometimes when I read books like this where there's like an implied murder mystery, I feel sort of let down at the end, but I really didn't. It was just like, oh, but this wasn't a murder mystery.
Well, it was definitely a Scooby-Doo mystery where, you know, you could never find out until they reveal it. Like, right. you know, you couldn't have figured out by the clues probably.
Yes.
I guess you probably knew the name was Dr. Rebello early on, but that doesn't really explain that she was the instigator in that one case.
It took me a couple of readings to figure out who the hell Dr. Rebello was.
Right, right. In spite of the narrator doing, I think, a good job differentiating the characters, I still got confused. I confused most of the original founders of time travel and... You
without
know,
a 3D diagram for your Apple Vision Pro, there's not much you can do to sort of break down this particular collection of random nodes.
And I don't think it was like inherently confusing. I think it was just many of the characters didn't have huge parts in the book, but they were part of the system, but there were only two or three sort of main characters in the story.
Right. there was B, there was Ruby, there was Odette, and then there was Margaret.
Right.
And Patrick the Rabbit.
And then there was the reporter who Odette finds out that she ends up marrying in the future when she's looking up to see, you know, that's sort of one of those time loopy things where you're like, you know, he gets threatened and they show his family being killed. And so you think, well, if these are pictures from the future and if it's faded, then they're all going to be killed. But she says they weren't. So well, I guess Photoshop.
Actually, no, they're just pictures of all of them dead. And it turns out.
Oh, okay. So maybe
one of Margaret's standard hazing rituals that she will send time travel recruits, like pictures of their relatives dead. So it was Margaret.
Or themselves.
Or themselves, etc. For a lot of families, it just wouldn't be that much of a threat because it'd be like, and this is your son, dead at 80, surrounded by beloved relatives. But,
right.
You know, in his case, you know, there were enough disturbing.
Yeah, he didn't know, right. Like, if it was a threat or not. And she just says, oh, yeah, in the future, you've written these things and your family isn't hurt.
Right.
And so he writes it. And so that's one of those, like, well, does he write it because he knows for sure that they're okay?
That is, in this universe, the wrong question, because free will is an illusion.
Yes, he did it because he did it.
Right, and, because the word because doesn't mean anything in this universe. I hadn't really thought about this, but of course this was written in 2020. So there's talk about the original series of Doctor Who, but no talk about the revival. And that would make sense.
True.
Because you wouldn't have Doctor Who in a universe where time travel is an actual thing.
It wouldn't be that fantastical, I guess.
Right. It'd be like now, bus driver!
Get in your bus and drive over there. Cool. I guess what I'm saying is that because of the fadedness of time travel in this universe, time travel apparently stops in around 2020 something or 2223 something. At least they can't travel past that point. So they think maybe, you know, they don't have it after that point, but they don't know why.
Because of all the candies in my
yes,
personal reading.
It's not because they went back in time and stopped time travel from being invented, which happened in another book that I read that was, you know, came out about the same time. It's a different take where my brain was expecting it to go because, you know, the fate thing is so rare in time travel books.
This is actually my personal theory as to why time travel doesn't exist in our timeline. It's that any timeline where you run into a paradox, it just sort of negates that entire timeline. and so we don't consciously experience it. And so there's every once in a while, somebody will have some chance of inventing a time machine. And then in all of those branches, it eventually causes some kind of paradox. And so it self-negates.
So it's just sort of like min-max timelining where it gets pruned. And
Yeah, we only consciously experience sort of the average timeline. And there's constantly other ones branching off. For example, there's 15 versions of me trying frantically to keep me from saying some stupid shit that I'm about to say. And then, like, that causes a paradox. So that universe suddenly goes away. And so... So, you know, it's constantly flickering out of existence and we never actually see it.
That would tend to help with the whole infinite parallel universe problem where right. It's like, no. They just, you know, it's like the particles that are created and then collide and you know, annihilate each other constantly.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was at least an interesting take on time travel that was less common.
Yes, it's actually kind of new for me because normally that sort of time travel, it's either kind of played for laughs, like in the Doctor Who episode, the Pandorica opens, the Doctor winds up with a slightly different type of time machine that is actually really bad for the universe, so he normally doesn't do it. He does a lot more quick hop time travel, and so is interacting with his own time loop a little bit more, and so is doing things like, I'm dead upstairs right now. And sets up all kinds of little predestination paradoxes of, oh, why did you show up to this meeting? Oh, because you got this message? Here. Okay, now I've given you the message.
Right. And you're right. They kind of played that for laughs, and it was a great scene, basically, that they did all that stuff. But it only worked in a very limited situation in the series, as hand-wavy as Doctor Who is, it would be like much more hand-wavy to do that all the time.
Yeah, and for the reasons shown by this book, you either have to be just completely inured to the fact that, oh, free will is not a useful concept, which is right. Actually my own personal belief after, like, I'm not a professional philosopher or psychologist or, I don't know, free willetician. But it's just like, the more you look into things like this, it's just like, oh, well, saying free will doesn't exist says a lot of crazy things. And saying, oh, free will definitely exists also gives you a lot of crazy things. So if either yes or no are answers that don't make any sense, then the concept is wrong.
It's another one of those, like, add another meta layer to make it make sense.
I think
the concept that free will doesn't exist probably terrifies me to the point that I can't watch media where it talks about it too much. Like, it just, it,
that's
like,
just because all the molecules in your brain interact in that particular way.
Right. It's just the thought that everything is totally predestined. It's just depressing because I should be emperor of the universe and I'm not. So,
well, but then it also means that it's not your fault that you're not emperor of the universe.
You're right. So everything is fine.
Everything is fine. Well, everything is. That's the only thing you can say, in fact, in this kind of universe. All right. I think we've destroyed this particular discussion as much as we possibly can.
Yes.
So, it is time for us to time travel to some unspecified time in the future. I'm hedging my bets here. And review some other audiobook. Until next time, we are SF3!
Yay, SF3. Glorious.
Glorious. If you like SF3, we'd appreciate it if you'd leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you leave podcast reviews. We'd also be very grateful if you'd support us over on Patreon at patreon.com/SF3podcast, where you can suggest new books or other topics for us to talk about. In any case, thanks for listening. Our theme music is SF3 by Christian Plant, used by permission.